Blog Talk Radio.
Project Radio, welcome back. I am one-third of your hosts, Frankie Metro, of course, and I believe with me on the line is Ms. Lynn Alexander. Is that you?
I don't hear Lynn. This is not... Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, actually. This is Paul Corman Roberts, actually. I work
with
him.
Well, you're kind of fading in and out. I hear a lot of feedback over the line.
Yeah, I'm using the Skype right now, and it's making me sound very robotic, so do apologize for that. Hopefully we can work through the technical difficulties. It's like this is Draconian Vampire Tunnel or anything else, so we don't do that. So.
That's right.
I don't know, man. Today's topic, of course, Q Radio, we are back. Today's topic being romantic relationships and writers. That's the best place to start with that probably would be, well, you know what? Actually, Lynn Alexander on here now, so I'm going to bring her in, and we'll see where we can get started at. I kind of feel like she's the mug hen of this thing. I don't know about you. let's bring in Lynn Alexander at area code 724, which I believe is here.
Hi, I don't know if I'm on or not. I have a terrible connection tonight. I'm sorry about that.
No,
can you guys hear me?
It seems to be going around. I think yes, we can.
Okay, cool. All right, I wasn't sure. Sorry to start it off on an awkward note, but good evening, and glad to see you guys have gotten things going. So we're talking about love, are we?
It always seems like it ends with Sylvia's head in the oven to me. That's my take on it. You know, to get together, you know, the woman sticks her head in the oven, and the guy goes on to, you know, write a book about it and make a lot of money on her sticking her head in the oven. So I don't know. I know that's not a great template to start with, probably.
Well, it's a bit of a simplification, but... well, you know what? But what I'm sort of picking up on here, and you correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure you will, is that there's a gender issue sometimes to this question also, as far as in terms of roles and what the expectations are about women and their time and their responsibilities to families and households. And I think that plays in when you're talking about you know, creative work and what people do with their time in a relationship.
Yeah, who's how do you divvy up the writing time?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that, you know, I think it was an interesting topic idea that, you know, that Frankie came up with, and I, you know, give him props for that, because I think it's an interesting question. I mean, can it work out, you know, if... Particularly if two people, I mean, it's hard enough as it is. I mean, we all know it's hard enough as it is. A lot of people work, you know, work day jobs, and they're trying to squeeze these things in, you know, in between other responsibilities, and it's hard enough. But then when you have two people in a relationship, you know, trying to do that, you know, does it work? I mean, does it get competitive? Does it get, you know, does it get ugly? I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways to look at it, so...
I like to think that it gets all of those things, just not all at once, hopefully. I was actually looking at the RSVP page for Project U Radio, and Frank Reardon, Mr. Frank Reardon, Mr. Southie Boston, who won't call into this show because he can't have anything to do with that, he actually made a very good point, and I'm just going to go ahead and read that as soon as I can pull it up here on Facebook. I hope you guys can hear me a lot better now.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
great,
I can.
Great. Yeah, I was trying to use Skype with the. I was trying to use Skype here, and it just wasn't happening. So, but getting back to getting back to Mr. Frank Reardon here, he made a very, very interesting quote or comment earlier. Let me see here. I'm just trying to pull it up. And, of course, Facebook now wants to give me some problems. Ah, here we go. I am not sure it could be entirely true. I mean, I understand, but being with women who are not in their own heads can be maddening. I don't think writers are doomed to be alone, but being with another creative person is almost our only chance. And I think that's a very I like the fact that he said that it's almost our only chance. It kind of leans to the issue of connection and loneliness and being a writer. Typically, I mean, as Paul Coleman Roberts mentioned earlier about Sylvia Plath in the oven, you run into situations where you're with writers. It's very you can run into situations where it would be easier for you to be alone or what have you. But I think Frank makes a very, very good point there that sometimes it seems like we need another creative outlet. We need somebody that actually falls into the lines with that in order to, well, I don't know, as he said, save us. I don't know.
I think that what Frank, I mean, Frank always has a lot of smart things to say, so I always, you know, I always tend to wish he would call and you know, share more of it. But I think that he's sort of looking at it from the other side. I mean, we tend to focus when we look at a question on what are the negatives, what are the tragic outcomes, what are the terrible consequences. And, you know, I think that what he's, you know, if he's right to bring up is that, you know what, isn't there something to be said for finding somebody who gets it, who understands, you know, your needs and your pressures and what you're up against? And I think there's also the sense that, you know, you're almost splitting your heart a little bit, you know, because you're chasing two different things. You know, there's the relationship, but then there's this whole, you know, creative, you know, passion that you have alongside. And, you know, there are many times where, you know, one is pitted against the other. And I think that, you know, if you are with somebody that understands that, you know, that there is hope that, you know, you can connect in a way that maybe you can't with somebody who, you know, doesn't understand, you know, what drives you and why you do what you do. I think it's very important that people you're with understand at least, you know, why you do what you do and how you feel about it, how important it is to you. So, you know, I could see where he's coming from, I think, with that.
Great. Yeah, that's a very good point there.
You have to look at it from the other point of view too. It's if you're not, you know, you might be partnered up with somebody who is not sort of a creative writer or a creative personality. Not that they aren't entirely uncreative, but you know they're not living. You know they're not committed to a world where you know you need your time to be creative and to do something that's rather abstract, something that's rather difficult to make a living at. Because we see so many artists mm-hmm. who pair up with people who are, you know, in more practical, more lucrative fields. You know, it's kind of like the, you know, getting a sugar mama or a sugar daddy to support you, be your patriarch or matriarch to support you through a career. And you know, and there are varying degrees of arrangements that come into that, but it would seem to me that in the case where, in the opposite situation where you've got, you know, two creative people getting together, you have to be willing to make certain sacrifices. You know, you're not probably going to live a very traditional lifestyle if you go that way.
Probably not.
That's an interesting point there. Very interesting point. What type of sacrifices do you think generally follow along with the writer relationship there, Paul? I mean, you have a situation
you're not going to be property owners of any kind. You know, you're gonna have a little more. You're gonna have to have a little more flexible bohemian lifestyle. You know, you're gonna, you'll probably have like part-time work, or you'll be looking for flexible work, so you can have more time for your creative endeavors. I mean, there's, you know, there people will go to incredible measures to give themselves the time to really imagine, you know, big creative projects. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, it doesn't have to be writing. It doesn't have to be literary. It could be any type of artistic endeavor, you know. But mm-hmm. I think a lot, because artists are in their way sort of, you know, have their way or try to push themselves into thinking outside of the box, it sometimes might seem easier, I think, and you might get more support from another creative person in having a flexible sort of option in doing that. But again, it's tricky, you know. But if you're also a shared household, you know, there's also the work that has to be done in the shared household and the responsibilities that have to be divvied up there. And of course, that's a whole other realm that plays into it, you know.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, I'm actually looking at an article here called "I Married a Novelist." You guys can actually find this at the rumpus.net. I believe I did post this on the Project Q Radio RSV page.
Right.
Excuse me, RSVP page. But as I'm reading along here, there's one thing that's really sticking out to me is like one selection here says they seem to look at two writers living together as somehow unnatural, a zookeeper's mistake. Perhaps it goes against our idea of how writers should be spending their time. If they're not masturbating in the middle of the day, we expect them to be hunting lions or shooting apples off women's heads or matching drinks with famous painters. We expect them to be suicidal or drug addicted or generally unhinged. And certainly we expect them to mistreat their spouses, though long-suffering caregivers. We do not expect them to put Elmo puppets on their hands or watch reality TV with their families or launch inquests into who left the washcloth at the bottom of the tub. That's very, very good point there. I like that. Now, that brings up my next question for you guys. What are the quirks that go along with being in a writer-to-writer relationship? Do we have the same things that we disagree about as opposed to being a regular relationship with between a grocer and a school teacher or something like that?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that one point that came up in what Paul was saying is that, you know, there's the need to connect and maybe have a match that works and makes sense with what you do creatively. But I think also economically, I think that it's also a question that gets into your economic priorities as a couple. And You know, a lot of people can relate to the question of, well, how could you spend so many hours doing something that doesn't generate income, that doesn't, you know, and I think you have to share the same mindset about your economics in a relationship, especially if you share a household or you're married or you're in that situation. I think that that's a big thing, because very often you are putting a lot of time into something that isn't bringing in money or not a lot of money. And I think that you have to be with somebody who respects that it has a value to you that's not necessarily monetary. So I think that that's the economic issue is sometimes comes out a lot more than the question of can two creative people be together? I mean, can two people with different economic goals be together? I mean, you know, if you're worried about your 401k and that's what your priority is, you're going to have a very hard time living with somebody that's, you know, a painter or a writer that's not necessarily making a lot of money doing what they do. So, you know. And, I mean, I think that as far as what you read, I think that's very true. I think that we have this sometimes glorified, sometimes, you know, mythic sense of what these people are like, what they're doing, you know, and we don't think of them as regular people in their homes, you know, and I think even the internet, you know, perpetuates some of that. You know, you think about different people, you don't imagine because of the persona that you see that they're, you know, home in sweatpants eating Cheetos, you know. And I think that's a good point that's in there, that, you know, the sense that people have to necessarily have a destructive relationship or that there's an abusive relationship, you know, kind of, I think it bothers me, that idea that to be creative you have to have a volatile, toxic personality and you have to be, you know, necessarily unhinged. You know, I don't think that's necessarily true. Well, it might be for Paul. No,
I was going to say, some of us have stereotypes to perpetuate, I guess.
Well, I like that you brought up the relationship there with writers today. Talking about present day writing relationships, how do you guys think that the inclusion with social media and the small writing community, how do you think that's changed the overall format between the writer-to-writer relationship? Paul, how do you think that's changed?
Well, it probably makes it easier to meet people. You know, I think even before this social media, I think there was a lot of romance attached to the small press writer-to-writer relationship. You know, these wild, passionate romances that burn out very quickly. You know, I think the internet helps perpetuate a lot of that sort of just by the nature of what it is. You know, it's this, you know, it's just this power, this powerful gatherer of information and deliverer of data, and you can interface and you can break barriers down between people over long distances in ways you never have before. You know, and I think, you know, and there's a large percentage of people, no lack of them in the small press either, they get kind of a rush, they get kind of a high off of that thing, you know, to probably to a certain amount of detriment, I'm sure. You know, it's, I think it's in the place, or we need to get to a place where we practice spending a lot of time offline just to maintain kind of a grip on reality. But, you know, it's, I don't think I'm alone. I will openly confess I've, you know, got involved in, you know, sort of online relationships that get heady, and you kind of wonder, like, wow, where do these lines get drawn besides physical space, and how long before you overcome those barriers? And some people have no desire to overcome those barriers because, you know, somehow won't jive with the reality that they're sort of creating in their own mind about a relationship that is perhaps more fulfilling to them and more mysterious as long as it remains, you know, hidden behind the veil of the computer monitor. But I think a lot of people can overcome that too. That's a very unusual dynamic, I think, that's come into it over the past few years. But that's something, again, where if a writing or creative couple meets via social media or social networking, they're going to have to deal with the fact that they're both these sort of social network creatures when they get together, and that they're not necessarily going to be cut off from all these other people they've been talking to when they live together. You know, so that's...
You mean like the fishbowl?
Something like that. Yeah. You know, and everything, you know, and all this stuff is sort of reflected back at you, you know, everywhere, and it's like it's immediate, like, you know, it's sort of immediate visual feedback, I guess, of some sort or another. But it's, I would have to think that makes for some interesting politics between, you know, the partnered writers. You know, they don't even necessarily have to be male to female. You know, we have gay writers in our community too. You know, it can be partners of any kind. It's always, I think that's definitely going to just create this element that is so much more complex. And we hope that complexity makes us better artists, but, you know, we hope it doesn't make us complete dicks as human beings either.
Interesting. Well, I'm really glad that you brought up the homosexual dynamic. That was one thing that I really wanted to explore, specifically the relationship between, we can look back in time, actually. We can look back to Paul Verlaine and Arthur Rimbaud.
Yeah.
That was probably the most volatile example of a writer relationship ever, I think.
Yeah, that's one of those really torturous, like, high passion. That's that heavy end passion burning really, really high. Although to hear Rambo's side of the story, it says, like, oh, you know, I'm just a street hustler that was using this gay guy. But it doesn't seem like it was pretty hard for Artie to get into character, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh. I agree with that. Liam, what's your take on that?
Well, you know what? I think it kind of goes back to, I mean, and you can look at all kinds of literary couples. I mean, you know, he started off talking about, you know, poor Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes, and, you know,
who could resist?
Well, I think, you know, we can think of a lot of examples where, but we could also say that maybe part of why there's this fascination with them and their story and their relationship story is because there's, you know, it's sort of like that idea that you can't go by a car wreck without, you know, looking, even though it's, you know, it's horrible. I mean, I think there's a fascination with these people and their relationships, particularly when they're awful. You know, I think there's a curiosity about that, you know, and people, I think it just makes the story of their lives even more compelling to a lot of people. But I think it also has fed into that, you know, idea, that stereotype of dysfunction, of being, you know, or being so self-centered, you know, and obsessed with pursuing the art aspect of their lives, that they're very neglectful or you know, I think that's a shame, because I think that, you know, it's it's almost a glorification of things that are tragic, you know, and I don't know that that's I think that's a sad way to look at a lot of people's relationships, because there's a lot of good that came out of them too. You know, there are a lot of examples of very positive relationships, you know, that of people who, you know, really were able to be supportive. And even in communities, I mean, there are a lot of groups of people that, because of their alliances with each other romantically or otherwise, they were able to, you know, really put together movements and get things done, get things accomplished that you can't really do alone. So, you know, my take on a lot of the relationships, you know, that we hear about is that, you know, I don't know why we're so fascinated by the toxic, terrible ones, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of positive benefit.
Like watching kind of like watching an action movie of sorts. I think it's a big fascination for us to see. I mean, it's kind of human, really. You guys pass a car wreck. I mean, if you pass a car wreck, you're obviously going to look and see what's going on there, as opposed to when you drive by and see somebody picking flowers out of the park, you're not necessarily going to pay that much attention to it. I'm reading an article here on the RSV page from The Guardian. You guys can go to www.guardian.co.uk, find this article, or you can go to the Project U Radio RSVP page as well. But it's actually an article called Authors in Couples Make for Unhappy Endings. And one of the things in here that I really, really loved was they're talking about contemporary writers. I'll just read a little excerpt of this. It was so sweet it could have come straight from the pages of a Harley Quinn romance. According to the New York Times article published on the occasion of their 1995 wedding, novelist Robert Olin Butler and Elizabeth Dewberry knew they were meant for each other when they could sit in a room together and not only write, but also write well. But now with Elizabeth having abandoned her Pulitzer Prize-winning husband for media mogul Ted Turner, their marriage now seems rather more like something from a book by Jonathan Franzen. And a beautifully emailed to the graduate students he teaches in a creative writing program at Florida State University, Butler explained that among other reasons, his relationship with Dewberry had become untenable because Elizabeth has never been able to step out of the shadow of the Pulitzer, the multitude of small reflections of regard that came my way inevitably threw a spotlight on the absence of those expressions of regard for her. Paul, what's your take on the shadow that can loom over the relationship when you're in a relationship with another writer?
I have known a couple of writer couples where there's one who's getting a lot more attention, a lot more play, and the other one, unique perspective I have, where the other writer I was able to recognize was quite different, perhaps a little less mainstream than her partner, but who was very talented in her own right, and it's kind of like, well, how. You know, and they're still together today. You know, they have found a way to make that work. You know, it's kind of like, well, if one is a slam poet that's getting some accolades in the press, and you know, the other is sort of going to be a prose writer who's probably going to have it. But you know, you hope for an academic career, maybe, and something that way. If you're comfortable with yourself, if you're comfortable with your identity as a writer, I don't see where that shadow should be a problem. That's easy to say, too. You know, that's real easy for me to say. I'm not myself personally in a relationship like that. I'm really probably not qualified to say. On the other hand, I can see two writers involved with each other being comfortable with each other, being confident in themselves as well, and that being a way or that being a path that it could work. But, you know, writers are an infamously insecure lot. And so, of course, that shadow, more often than not, you know, I can see why people would bet money that it's always going to be a problem, that it's always going to come between partners if that dynamic is at work. But, I mean, how many writers get to be Robert Olin Butler, though? You know, how many, most of us are doomed to toil away in obscurity anyway. So it's like, it really shouldn't be a problem on that level, you know?
I agree. Let's see, Lynn, what's your take, Lynn, on, of course, the writer's shadow and how that's actually passed over onto other writers there?
Well, you know what, I would love to say that, you know, something about, well, if you're secure and you know, comfortable in your own skin, then it won't matter. And, you know, the ideal answer is to say that you are happy with the success of the people that you love and that you support them. And, you know, it's and that, you know, you think it's a wonderful thing when someone else is getting the attention and you're not. But that being said, I think human nature being how it is and the way that the ego comes into this, which certainly for writers and creative people is you know, a big issue also, and the insecurities and the way that it manifests in, you know, the desire for attention. You know, sometimes we're very attention-seeking people, not all of us, but many are. And I think, you know, when you're in the position of sort of being in the shadow, you know, which, you know, I've been a long time ago, I think that I would handle it very differently now than I had the ability to handle it then. You know, at the particular time, you get very tired of, you know, nobody knowing your name and being so-and-so's friend or so-and-so's girlfriend or you know, you get tired of that. You know, you realize that you're invisible. You realize that what you do in those circles, you know, doesn't seem to really matter. And it does get tiresome. It does get to you. And I think that that's maybe a maturity thing. It's something that maybe in your 20s, maybe you deal with differently than you would when you're older. But I think the other thing is also that in the relationship itself, you know, there can be an entitlement there. You know, I'm the one who's, you know, really got a shot at being somebody. I'm the one who's really, you know, on the right track. So, you know, you should be the one to, you know, work two jobs so that I can stay home and, you know, do what I do. And if you support me in my greatness and my aspirations, then by all means, you know, the way to show that to me is by, stepping up and making sure that my needs are met, and there can be a resentment around that and a bitterness that comes out in that kind of a scenario after a while, because you want to believe that the person you're with thinks that what you do with your time is valid too, and that your aspirations are important, you know, even if you're not, you know, seen by other people as important or significant or famous or any of those things. You know, I mean, you know, there's still validity to what everybody chooses to do with their time. And I think you really have to be with someone who respects that, you know, and isn't in competition with you about that.
I think if you could recognize that as, I mean, within your identity as a writer, you have very specific communities that will be, you know, appreciative of both artists. You know, the artists in themselves, I think, you know, just, you know, in the classic sense of the word, need to not just have a room of their own. I think they have the right to seek out a community of their own too. I think that's a two-way street, and it's got to be recognized by both partners for it to really, you know, I think for it to really work. But that's, again, you know, easier said than done.
Indeed.
Right. What if you're in the same community? You know, what if you come from the same community? And then it's complicated, doesn't it? Then everyone is choosing sides, and you know, that can be difficult too. You can feel like you're no longer, you know, like you're not just breaking up with a person, but you're breaking up with a group, a community that you have.
Yeah.
You know,
I've known that to happen for people like in the Burning Man community and in the Ren Faire community, when, you know,
right,
people are they're sort of tribal, and then, you know, and then they meet up and then it doesn't work out, and it's kind of like, oh, those are moments that you find out who your real friends are.
All right, you sure do. you do. You know, I mean, you know, I can, you know, Paul knows, you know, a lot about, you know, the things that I'm talking about, because, you know, we've been over some of that, and you know, it's very difficult. It's the kind of thing that I think, like I said, when you're younger, maybe when you're less sure of yourself and what you're about, and, you know, maybe you're still at the point where you're wondering why you even bother. I mean, it doesn't take a whole lot to kind of push you toward the edge of self-doubt. And you know, that kind of a relationship where you do feel like you're less than, I think can do that. You know, and I would love to say that we all, you know, kind of sit here and say, oh, well, you know, nothing in the world would ever stop me from doing what I love, and no one could discourage me. But that's, you know, it's very difficult. It takes a lot of strength to do that, you know, in that kind of relationship, if the person is a jerk about it, you know, particularly. So
if that ego entitlement gets involved, yes.
Exactly.
And you guys bring up a great point about age. Myself being one of the younger writers, I have been in a couple of relationships before with writers. And I do find that sometimes it is a little bit harder, especially if I was dating someone that was a little bit older than myself. Sometimes it is a little bit harder to quell that ego, because everybody has ego. It's impossible to avoid. Everybody has it. And it is a little bit harder to quell. I think one dynamic that we're not really talking about here, though, and it's something that really plays a strain on any sort of relationship, of course, whenever you're in a relationship with anybody, is when families are involved, when children are involved, of course, that being the case, like if it's not your children or if you just come into a relationship with a person and they have children, what's your guys' take on that? Paul, what's your take on that?
Well, that's, I mean, you know, I guess that speaks to the heart of maturity. A lot of writers notoriously haven't taken much responsibility for their kids. We talk about the man who shot attempted to shoot the apple off of his wife's head and wound up killing her. Was also not the greatest father. It was funny. You sit there when you're sitting there talking about ego and all of us, this is terrible. But you're sitting there talking about it's just human to have ego, which I absolutely 100% agree with. But I wanted to blurt out and say, yeah, everywhere except Naropa, Frankie, where there's nothing but ego death every day. But that is, because there are those writers who believe that they do practice ego death, but really, how much do they do that? I don't know. You know, parenting is something that either comes naturally to a person or it doesn't. And I don't know. I'm pretty biased on this issue, being a parent myself. My writing, when it comes to the needs of my daughter, my writing has to take a back seat. You know, it's as much as I love it, as much as I do identify with it, as much as it's a part of my identity, and I need it to be who I am. It has to play second fiddle to, you know, my commitment to my child. And that's just me. There's a lot of writers out there who just don't feel that way about it, and they have kids. And, you know, this is one of those real individual things, you know, that you struggle with. Hopefully you've got a partnership or a relationship where you have support. And certainly if you are a parent and you're going to be successful as a parent and have the space you need to write, you're going to have support from a partner. Otherwise, you're going to have to work a lot harder.
Right. Indeed.
I think that it comes to mind somebody like Diane DePrima. I mean, you know, there are, I mean, you can, you know, a lot of the biographical information about her and her, you know, attempts to, you know, be a mother. And, I mean, she's, I think, has like 5 kids from, if I remember correctly. I think that it was said to her, you know what, you really have to sort of, you know, you sort of have to choose, because if you're running out of here because the babysitter's, you know, got to be out of there by 11, you know, you're basically missing the party. And I think, and I don't want to get into like a gender distinction or a female versus male or a mother versus father thing, but I think there's a big distinction between the social life and the hanging out and the networking and the scene part of being a writer and the actual practice of doing it. You know, there are a lot of people who say, well, you know what, I can't. I'm a parent. I have to put all of my time into raising my children. And, you know, they do feel a sense of missing out on a lot of the scene part of it. But, you know, I think that's very different than, you know, when you're alone in your room actually doing the writing. And the other part of that is that I think, and this goes whether you're talking about relationships or anything else, I think that one thing you maybe learn as you get older is that it's very important to model for the children relationships, that you can have you know, you can have your creative outlet. You can do the things that you want to do, and that being a mother or a father doesn't make you a martyr. It doesn't mean that you can never leave the house. And I think many women in particular that I know can relate to that sense of, you know, not that you're doomed now because you have children, but, you know, like, oh, I'll never be able to do the things that, you know, I love to do. And you have to find a way to do that regardless, just like you have to find a way to have relationships regardless. I mean, being a parent doesn't mean that, you know, you have this, this letter on your chest that you're untouchable and that you can't do anything with your life. You know, I think you have
to find
a way.
Wait. When did this come down the line? When did this happen? I didn't get the notice on that.
No, but yeah. I think that there, and like I said, I'm speaking from my experience with other women in particular. I mean, I can't speak for how it is for a father, you know, or whether it's different or not, but I think that, you know, very often women are the ones in a divorce situation, for example, not always, but, you know, that are trying to date with children and are kind of maybe considering things when they get into a new relationship about security or stability for the kids or whether this is a good lifestyle for children, you know. And those are all very individual, questions. And I think that relates to relationships because I think that whether you're a man or a woman with children, you do look at that potential partnership in a very different way when there are other mouths to feed other than your own. You know, I think you maybe look at, you know, like some of the volatility that we talked about. You know, when you have little ones in the next room, you might be less inclined to, get involved in some of the shooting apples off people's heads kind of things. You know, it loses a little bit of,
hopefully.
You know.
Or in
know,
some cases, perhaps
say.
More than ever, you know, it's kind of like, oh, my God,
maybe so.
out to get out of the household and things like that. But so,
right. And,
speaking of getting out, I apologize, guys. I have to step away here to engage in my parental responsibilities this evening.
Perfect timing. Yeah.
I know. I'm so sorry. But I'm hoping there's other people calling in I know there's folks listening, but I hope some folks call in with some of their insights too. And I've had a lot of fun talking to you guys tonight.
Well, we appreciate it, Paul, and I appreciate you setting a good example there by jumping off your own thing.
By ducking out on the show to go beat my kid.
Right.
I know, to go to my example. Well, I do what I can. I do what I can, but I will definitely be talking to you guys next week too.
Oh, great,
right,
man.
No,
well, thanks for stopping by.
Good night. And if you don't mind me mentioning
night,
that next week we have the raffle too, the roast and raffle.
Right.
So if you don't mind me throwing that out there at this point, you know.
And if you have a roast for Brian Fugit, make sure you get it all nice and tidy and ready to go for next week, because I'm sure there's going to be a long queue line of people wanting to get their cuts in on Mr. Zygote.
Right. Well,
bring plenty of Tylenol.
I know we'll let Paul go do his thing, but if you don't mind, I don't mean to like switch topics real, but I did want to mention that, you know, one of the reasons that the raffle is, you know, it's meant to be kind of, you know, humorous. I mean, you know, the prizes obviously are ridiculous, and, you know, but the very real issue that's not funny is that a lot of people don't realize how much money goes into some of these things. You know, there's websites, there's server space, there's hosting to pay for, and, you know, nobody's crying about that. I mean, we all do these things as a labor of love and because we want to do them, but, you know, certainly it doesn't hurt every now and then, you know, and it makes us feel appreciated certainly when somebody, you know, steps up and throws a few bucks in the little donation thing on PayPal, and, you know, I mean, it's a way of saying that, you know, we're doing a decent job and that we're doing something valuable, but it's also, you know, it also helps. I mean, people have no idea with postage and printing and, you know, just how much it adds up, and in particular for Michelle. I mean, Michelle does a wonderful job. She, you know, she mails things, she collects things and sends them out, she gets books printed up, and we all know how much that costs. And so, you know, I just wanted to get into that a little bit, you know, explain some of the reasoning is, you know, it really is to sort of, you know, find a way to maybe be lighthearted about it, you know, as opposed to groveling and whining and complaining about it. But, you know, that's the idea behind it, just to sort of draw a little attention to the fact that, you know, hey, we have some expenses this month. And, you know, I mean, $5, you know, it goes to good use.
It's a pack of cigarettes, you know,
right.
Or, you know, you can help support the arts. And I'm all about helping supporting the arts. In fact, Lynn, can you tell everybody where they can go to find all that information, where they can donate, of course, and find all the schedules for upcoming Project U Radio shows?
Right. Well, thank you for reminding me, because I meant to actually try to sneak that in there. But we do have a page on the Literary Underground site. So if you go to theliteraryunderground.org/ProjectU Radio, we have a whole page set up where we've been, you know, just trying to, we do have a PayPal link on there, you know, a donation link. We have, you know, just some information about the raffle and the prizes and the different, you know, crazy things that you could potentially win. You know, all you have to do is, I mean, you could donate $1 or $5. It doesn't matter, but anybody who does gets their name put into the hat, so to speak, and then, you know, you can you know, we could do it that way. And you know, we've also been adding the show topics and different things on there. So, you know, hopefully that helps people.
Yeah, it's a very swank website. You guys can go to theliteraryunderground.org. Of course, you can find all that information. Schedule looks great. I have to say, Lynn, I am very impressed with the topics that we're going to be covering during the month of January. I'll just let everybody know that, of course, as you mentioned, next week we'll have the raffle show. I love the title of it, The Special Tainted Dayton Show and Raffle.
Right.
I love that. It's really
good
stuff.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know,
and then,
people have said, why are we picking on him, you know? But he is turning 40, and, you know, who else can you think of that would be more fun to, you know, make fun of?
Pick on than the
cackle
tackle. Yes.
That's right. You know,
I totally agree.
He's deserving of abuse, so, yeah.
Yes.
And he can take
lots
it. See, that's the thing. Like, I could never take it, you know, I can dish it out, but I could never take it. I mean, Brian, you know, when all is said and done, Brian can, you know, he's tough. He could take it. So, you know, we'll have to bring it on.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the week after that, January 20th, is going to be the Editorial Discretion Show. I'm very excited for that one. And of course, you know, that's discussing whether you'll publish work with content that you think is personally objectionable, like racism, of course, and if you thought it was an otherwise good piece. How do you feel about a blanket policy about certain kinds of content, such as, you know, we don't publish anything that includes sexist elements or what have you? I'm just reading Lynn Alexander here, really. She's just making it, you know, that much easier for me, so really appreciate that. And then, of course, the following week, January 27th, 2012, will be Regrettable Candor, Confessional Remorse. That show will actually be about, you know, getting about too personal in your writing or identifying someone or yourself and regretting it. Basically, you know, when the real world crosses over with the independent press world. Great stuff
there.
Oh, and one last thing. We've actually conglomerated with Red Fez Radio, and now, coming up after this week, Red Fez Radio will be on every Friday following Project U Radio. So, two shows, one night. I'm very excited for that. Very excited.
Yeah, but not this week. I mean, it's still tomorrow, and actually,
right.
You know, I heard he's got a guest lined up, but I can't remember
who. Yeah, I heard about that guy. I've heard lots of stuff about
that.
That guy. Of course, tomorrow, Red Fez Radio visits with some douchebag named Frankie Metro. And
him.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, that guy. And, of course, I will go ahead and make this a point. We did put up in the show description that we will be discussing my new lingerie line, Metro J. Brought to you exclusively by Kmart, but that's neither here nor there, actually. We'll probably be discussing a lot of other things like root beer and Tim Murray's beautiful beard. So you guys tune in for that tomorrow at, I believe that's at 11 p.m. Central Time. Is that right?
Right. I think so. I think so. Yeah, I think that for now the Saturday schedule is how it was, and then after this week it's switching to Friday. So I think it's still at 11. Yeah,
right.
That's – wait, it's 11 his time, so
mm-hmm. – I think
yeah.
He's a Central cat, so –
Yeah. It gets confusing, and a lot of people. That's one of the issues that we have with these shows is the time zone, and you know, particularly like with yours, because it switches over into the next day, and then I see Wednesday for me and Tuesday for you, and you know, that's why I'm always asking you. Can't wrap my brain around it for some reason, you know.
No, I understand.
But, yeah,
I'm glad you brought that up actually, because coming up Tuesday night, late night radio. Brought to you by Literary Underground, Return of the Draconian Vampire Tunnel, Corpse Repairs. That's coming up Tuesday at 11 p.m. Mountain Time, which I believe is 10 p.m. West, 12 a.m. Central Time, and 1 a.m. your time, Lynn. So you'd be looking forward to that. Definitely.
Right.
We got great stuff coming up.
Yeah.
We do.
Yeah. And, you know, in defense of our topic, I mean, a lot of people did sort of privately say, you know, I'll listen and, you know, maybe, I mean, there are things, and people even commented to me privately, you know, their thoughts on the topic. They sort of said, you know, I don't think it works. I think it's a bad idea. But, you know, it's very difficult to talk about, particularly when, you know, a lot of people, let's face it, have exes out there, you know, and it's,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's an awkwardness about this topic. I mean, you know, a few people, I said, hey, you know, why don't you put your two cents in, and they said, hell no. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, I just, yeah, I mean, a lot of people, you know, don't really want to, you know, speak candidly on this issue.
Yeah. No, I have to be honest with you. I was a little bit nervous about that myself. As I mentioned, I've had some exes who are still in the writing community. And, of course, that's where I met my wife. So, you know, she actually expressed some concern to me before the show. She's like, well, you know, this could get ugly. I was like, yeah, you know, it could.
Yeah.
It really could. But that's the great thing about the Literary Underground, I think, and that's what I love about us, is we aren't afraid to tackle those kind of issues.
No.
We really aren't. I think that's what we need in this community, is we need an open forum to where we can discuss things like adults. And, you know, and when you got topics like this, like you said, it's opening up gateways for lots of, you know, negative feedback or what have you, and you're putting yourself out there a lot of times, so... But, you know, I'm glad we did it. I think it's actually a pretty good show. I think it went really well. One last thing that I did want to discuss about the romantic relationships and the writers, of course. It was a very interesting thing, a very interesting question brought up to me by Julie Burmeister Sate on the RSVP page. She asked, how about editors? And I'm not one to actually make... you know, any sort of distinction between an editor and a writer, but she did bring up a very interesting question asking about the relationship between the editor and a writer and romance and what have you. She had one quote here that says, one has an intrinsic need to correct what exists while the other wants to push past what's known. I just wanted to know your thoughts on that, Lynn. What do you think about is there any sort of difference between the editor-writer relationship and the writer-writer relationship?
Well, you know, it depends on how you look at it. I mean, I think most of us at this point are both. I mean, you know, one of the reasons we become, quote, editors is because we, you know, we like that we can provide a forum and a space and, you know, an opportunity to other people because we care about the medium and we care about the art and we you know, I look at it myself more as a producer. I mean, you know, I have more to do with getting stuff out there than I do actually sitting back and editing. I mean, that's not the majority of what I do. But I think that some people would say that when there's a relationship, an editor-writer relationship, that there's a conflict of interest there that, you know, that you'll be swayed by the fact that, you know, hey, this is my girlfriend. You know, I kind of have to get her in here. And, you know, but realistically, I think that that's an issue with friends in general. I mean, a lot of people are more likely to put their friends, their, you know, their colleagues there, you know, in certainly in the academic world, you know, one hand washes the other. And, you know, I don't know that that's very different. I don't know that, that because you're in a relationship that, you know, it's I mean, I guess it's a conflict of interest if you're, you know, if you think the person's work is terrible and you're pushing it through because, you know, you're in a relationship with them. You know, I don't know. I mean, I know there are cases also where people enter into relationships because they're hoping that that person's position as an editor, that, you know, the relationship will be beneficial for them. And, you know, that's pretty screwed up, too, you know.
Right.
You know, but I mean, I think to make like kind of like a blanket statement that, you know, that they're at odds with one another, you know, so much of what we do, we put ourselves in these little roles and pigeonholes, and most of us are a whole bunch of things. You know, people are editors, they're web designers, they're writers, they're artists, they do photography. I mean, I think people really now just wear a bunch of different hats. So, you know, I don't know, who cares?
Yeah. You know? No, you definitely got to wear different hats in this community. Excuse me. I will go ahead and say that 219, I do see you on the switchboard. I'm trying to pull you in, but for some reason, Blog Talk Radio is just not agreeing with me tonight. It's almost like acid reflux relationship between me and Blog Talk Radio.
Right. It's hit or miss. But definitely.
But I will try to bring you in, 219. Just hold on. Hold tight one moment, and we'll try to get you in there. But you bring up a very interesting point there about I don't even know if I should really touch on this because it's one of those topics that I was afraid could get a little ugly. But benefits to being in a writer-writer relationship, specifically, do people seek out other writers for beneficial gain sometimes? Do you think that is a phenomenon that's really prevalent in the independent press community?
Do I think so? I've seen it, and I know what goes on, and but I don't know. Again, I don't know that that's different than other industries. I mean, certainly if you're in a corporation, I mean, you know, that goes on there. I mean, you know, people make alliances and connections with other people, you know, in all kinds of ways for their own personal gain, you know. So I don't know that it's so different. I mean, why would we expect, you know, that this community would be above that, or that we wouldn't have that among our own? I mean, you know, sure we do. People are opportunistic. People, you know, see an opportunity to use whatever they can, you know, and it's a tough world. But really, you know, the thing that makes me kind of laugh about it is, you know, it's a lot of people chasing, you know, we're kind of like chasing crumbs. I mean, you know, very few people are really gaining from it, and it seems like a huge investment of time to, you know, I mean, I'm not knocking the independent press and small presses, but, you know, really, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I like to think most people are kind of above doing that, but I know they're not, you know, and I think it does happen. You know, there are people that they get readings, they get opportunities, you know, they're selected to participate in things completely based on the fact that they're connected to this other person. And it's almost like, you know, in the old days when marriage was about property and alliances and, you know, countries being able to be connected as allies. I mean, you know, there are alliances that happen in relationships too. It's no different than any other situation. You know, his friends would become your friends and the other way around. And yeah, I think that helps people, but you know,
right. That's
not hardly a reason to do it. You know, I mean, you know, you have to be, I guess, much more ambitious than I would ever be, you know,
right.
think that way, you know?
Yeah, that definitely, I mean, that goes back to what we were talking about earlier and what Paul had said about, Rimbaud's comment about Verlaine. Of course, he was just a street hustler out to, you know do over to gain something from, you know, this guy or what have you. So, I mean, I don't think it's really a prevalent situation in our community. I really have to say that. I don't think it's something I genuinely see most of the time. I really do see genuine relationships between writers, of course. And it seems like it's more or less about finding connection. And, of course, that's something that transcends being a writer or what have you, like we've been saying. It's about finding connection and all together. It really is. And I like seeing that sort of thing. I think it's a great thing that we have in this community right now where we have these type of relationships, because I think it brings out the best in both writers a lot of times. I really do. I see, you know, people like, well, for instance, I see people like April Michelle Bratton and Frank Reardon. Both of those people are very, very talented writers. I very much adore both of them. And
it's just something that I really like to see.
I really do. I will go ahead and say, 219, I do have you here. I'm going to go ahead and bring you in live and see what you have to say on the topic here. 219, you are live.
Are we live?
Hello. Yes, you're live. Hello.
I think you guys have gotten way off topic.
well, that's a good.
Yeah. That's why we got you to Karina.
Yeah. Well, I think it's just like anything else, you know. I mean, it's a balancing act, you know. I don't know what it's like to be in a relationship with another artist or anything like that, but I think, you know, my relationship experience, the fact is, it's a balancing act, you know. If I want to go taking off to Cleveland to do some kind of damn reading, you know, well, I gotta make sure the house is everything's tidy around here first. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. And, well, I agree. You say that you've never been in a relationship with another writer. Is that true?
That's true. Never with another artist of any kind. And let's see. So I don't know what that's like. I mean, I did see that movie of Gwyneth Paltrow played Sylvia Plath in that one movie. I saw that. It was on Ovation the other day, as a matter of fact, but it was all chopped up with commercials. And, you know, it's a thing, you know. You don't go over to the Taco Hut and get 10 tacos at once, you know. You get maybe 3 out of them. It's a balancing act, just like anything else in your life, you know. You're going to, like I said, you're going to run off out of town and do little faggy little poetry readings. You got to make sure mama and all the little chickadees are all in a row. You know what I'm saying?
I agree. So you got to make that goes back to the topic we were talking about with getting everything in line with your family and what have you before dedicating yourself to any sort of arts.
That's got to
be interesting.
And you have to learn how to work through the adversity of having a family as well. You know, if the bills or you know, any of the type of domestic things that come on in the day-to-day life, you have to be able to work through that adversity in order to have the energy to actually sit down and create any type of art, if you are an artist
true.
Or anything. I've learned to draw some energy from it, thinking, well, goodness, I mean, what would I do if I did have a quiet room? I'd probably take a nap, you know?
Well, I mean, I think what you're saying is almost that the ability to overcome a lot of those challenges, in a sense, you know, I mean, I like to think in a lot of ways it makes us learn how to be more productive. I mean, you know, I'm sure that you can relate to the experience of, you know, trying to do something with a sleeping baby in your lap or while they're taking a nap or trying to make good use of, you know, 7 a.m. before everything gets going, or 5 a.m. You know, I think that you learn how to actually find opportunities in your day because you don't have the luxury of time, you know.
Absolutely. You're going to use it to your utmost advantage.
You have to.
On the Fez show, you know, where I've had a lot of crazy things happening behind the scenes, and I've asked some listeners before if they heard any of it, you know, like I've asked J.D. Nelson or somebody if he's actually, did you hear the puking baby, you know, and they never catch any of it, so I try to do a pretty good balanced job when I'm on the air.
Right. No, I think you do. I mean, I think, but you know what, on the other hand, do you ever find that you, I don't want to say have to hide that aspect, but that in some circles, you know, it's like,
I have a rule.
I don't want to say it's,
I have a No, I have a rule in Alexander, and my rule is I don't share any of my personal domestic family life with anybody that I don't meet in person. I don't do the social networking and throw my family all over the place and to these absolute, actually strangers, you know, friends, but whatever that means. But if I meet you in person and I get to know you on a personal level, then I'll invite you into that lane. Like I had J.D. Nelson stay here prior to the ZyFest thing back in August, and he didn't even know I had a family, and I've known him online for since probably 2005 or so.
Right. I'm with you on that. I'm the same way.
I don't drag my family into it. But if I meet you personally, you know, I'll have you over for a Sloppy Joe's or something in Alexander.
Right.
I know you in person, and
I think you make a very good point there. And I'm actually pretty stunned sometimes when I see, and this isn't just in the writing community, but when I see how open people are about sharing, you know, these details.
Yeah,
and I'm very paranoid about that. And I think, I would even say that it almost puts sometimes kids at risk. I mean, people will put, you know, details
of,
you know, where their kids
go to
school. Yeah, exactly.
And stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
No, that's actually why I chose to use a pseudonym, was because I didn't want my real name to be put out there because of family issues that I had been experiencing with my own children and, of course, you know, with former spouses and whatnot. Is because that's why I go under the name Frankie Metro, is because...
But Frankie,
think about it, though.
You shortened your name from Frankie Metropolis to Frankie Metro. I think people are still going to find you.
Oh, yeah, I agree. They'll probably find me sooner or later there. So...
finding you is one thing, but, you know, finding your kids is another, and putting, you know, especially when people put their relatives and, you know, their aunts, their uncles, and, I mean, really, it really is putting a lot of, maybe I'm just paranoid, but I really have kind of strong feelings about that, you know, and I totally agree that, you know, and it's also on a need-to-know basis. You know, I mean, you don't, the idea that you owe people your personal details is absolutely dead wrong. You don't owe anybody anything. You owe people what you feel like telling them, you know, and no more than that, you know. And I've gotten that. People have said, you know, you don't ever say anything personal about anything. You don't put, you know, you don't put anything about yourself. You're mysterious about everything. Everything is like a cryptic, you know, or it's just promoting something, but there's very little about you, you know. Well, if you want to get to know me, that's a whole other situation, but I don't feel that, you know, 4,000 friends on some Facebook page need to know this, you know. I think that's smart, really. I do. You know, I can totally respect that.
And it's not like,
you know,
I'm keeping my wife and kids in the background so I can fuck hot chicks or something out on the road, you know. It's the personal thing, you know what I'm saying?
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's,
Thank you,
and that's another part of probably this show topic, too. I mean, certainly there are a lot of people that do that, you know, and that's fine. That's their choice. But, you know, no, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean it's because you're up to no good. Sometimes there's real legitimate threats out there, you know, especially when it comes to kids, you know. And, I mean, I see sometimes how much information is on there, and, you know, I can't believe it. You know, but that's me, you know. You know, but I think we're probably out of time.
I will go ahead and tell you guys that we are in the after hours segment.
So I think
got
I
about
we're...
56 minutes of...
Yeah.
You guys hear me?
Okay? So I...
Yeah, Frankie, I thought you left, but you're back.
Yeah, I'm sorry, and I went on my little tear about internet paranoia, but...
I just wanted to share that with you guys, and I'm very happy to be in the... Hold on a second. Somebody wants to say something.
Oh!
Never mind. Hello?
See, I love hearing that. I absolutely love when kids are on, and, you know, I think that's one of those things that, you know, I know that it's hard to do, to bring kids into the mix when it comes... You know, we're supposed to be cool, and, you know, we're...